They said it was the worst storm on the Mediterranean Sea in years and years. You hear some chuckles from this group here in front. This is the Providence Baptist Church group that has come in from Charlotte. A number of them were a part of the story I'm about to tell, so bear with us as they both groan and laugh in what you're about to hear. Storms are nothing to be trifled with. The song that you heard right at the beginning of our service was a song that our choir, by the way, did so incredibly well, thanks to our First Baptist Brass Ensemble that's here every Sunday. We're very thankful. We do have membership requirements, by the way. It was this joyful song about Let It Rain, and it's a song about a storm that was pretty bad. So storms are nothing to be trifled with. We'll get to that storm in a moment in the Bible from the 6th to the 9th chapter of Genesis. But this storm that we experienced as a Providence Baptist Church group in 2007 was one that was billed as a part of the 4th Missionary Journey of Paul tour. Now, this sounded like a good idea to me, to take a group from my church at the time to Athens, not Athens, Georgia, Athens, Greece, where we boarded a ship and began this 4th missionary journey of Paul, to go back in the steps of Paul, to reenact this missionary journey, to experience firsthand the places where Paul preached and taught. What we forgot was that on the 4th missionary journey of Paul, there was a horrible storm and a shipwreck. We had no idea how realistic this 4th missionary journey of Paul was going to be. We had left Athens, and in the evening, all of a sudden, the ship we were on began to toss and turn, and it was the worst storm, the crew said, that they'd ever experienced over the last decade. And here we were, 24 people from my church that I had told them this was going to be a great experience to learn more about Paul, and they were going, "We didn't know it was going to be so realistic." And we all, most of us, about 17 out of the 24, got terribly sick. If you've ever been on the sea, when the boat you're on is rocking back and forth and you start to get sick, death sounds pretty good. And we were really, all of us that were feeling terrible, were just desperate to have some kind of relief. And several in the group had discovered the magic of an injection that is apparently anti-seasickness. And so the word began to pass through our group, you got to go get a shot. Go to the infirmary, get a shot. That'll help. So finally the word gets to me. We all were just hunkered down in our cabins. And so I crawl up to the infirmary because the ship is swaying back and forth. And in the infirmary is a Russian doctor with a syringe in his hand. And he looks at me, and all over the floor of the infirmary are medicine cabinets and things that have fallen over. And he looks at me with his syringe and he goes, "It's disaster." Translated in English, it means, "It's disaster. This is horrible. Look at this place." And then he goes, "You want shot?" And I said, "Yeah." And he staggers across the infirmary and jabs the needle into my arm. And sure enough, I did begin to feel a little better physically. But still, we were in the midst of this storm. For 2 full days, we were tossing and turning. We ended up, finally, in the dining room, gathered together. And the waiters were trying to keep order in the dining room. But literally, glasses and plates were falling off tables. It was crashing all around. But there was a band playing music. And a couple, yeah, like the Titanic, exactly. Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay, so here it comes. That's Kate, by the way, who said that. So we're all just trying to survive. But a couple in our group, Vic and Jackie Kirkman, Jackie is here today. The band is playing, and we're all just hanging on. Things are falling off tables, and they got up, and they began to dance. Sometimes in life, in the midst of the storm, the resiliency of not just surviving, but figuring out how to thrive and maybe even dance. This is the story of the covenant that God has made with the people of God. Begins in the sixth chapter of Genesis with the first covenant made with a guy by the name of Noah. The story we heard sung just a few moments ago. Noah and the bow. We know it as a rainbow, but for the people in that first covenant experience, after the storm, the bow in the sky represented from them not only the sun coming out and the storm ending, but if you look at the bow carefully, for that ancient world, it was a disarmed weapon of war. It was a bow without an arrow. It was a sign of peace and covenant between God and the people, but it was also the divine hope that the people, for once, would figure out how to live together in peace and harmony. That was the first covenant made between God and the world in general, between the sixth and the ninth chapter of Genesis. By the 12th chapter of Genesis, we get more specific and we go from Noah and the bow to Abraham and the blessing. There is this crazy idea that somehow this older man and woman, Abraham and Sarah, will not only bear a son in their elder years, but that will begin a new covenant of blessing. With these radical words in a tribal society where people were just in it for themselves and they only trusted people that they were connected to by blood, there is this radical new idea. Abraham, I'm going to bless you so that you can be a blessing to all the families of the earth. This made no sense at the time. Surely it was confusing to people, the idea of, instead of fighting with each other and maintaining a sense of defensive posture, to actually be proactive in caring for other people who were not like you. It was an amazing thought, and it was one that still clung to the people of God, so that eventually it will reemerge, as we hear in a few moments, with the new covenant. For now, the blessing from Abraham, from God to Abraham, is kind of, it's battered and beaten from another natural disaster, eventually through famine, where the people of God suffer greatly and they find themselves as refugees in the land of Egypt, cared for by people not like them. And then we're told in the first verse of Exodus, and a Pharaoh arose who knew not Joseph, and then begins 400 years of horror, slavery, bondage that beat the people down, and the idea of blessing now is a distant dream that made no sense. But then there's liberation, wandering through the desert area, and there's now a new covenant, Moses and the mountain on Sinai, where the great gift in those days was boundaries for people who had experienced bondage for way too long, where generations had no idea how to maintain a civil society because they'd only been told what to do at the end of a whip. But now, the gift is a law and a sense of this is how we care for one another, this is how we order ourselves, and this is how we worship God in beauty and in truth. Moses in the mountain provided a sense of stability, a sense of identity, the possibility of purpose. Things still, though, with this new covenant through Moses and the mountain was a rocky time where survival was possible, but it was increasingly difficult, so that the people of God began to say, we don't want to just live with this law. We need a king. We need to feel good about ourselves. We need to have some kind of national identity. We need to have a country that we can be proud of. And so the covenant now moves from Moses in the mountain to David in the kingdom. Saul had been pushed aside, and now this king arises that people are enthralled by, excited over. The problem with human beings when we make them kings is the old adage, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And in the case of David, good guy though he started out to be, he really struggled with this whole thing of trying to figure out how to do it. The covenant now was, if you, God says to David, if you obey my commandments, follow my ordinances, it becomes a conditional statement. So that there are certain things that are not supposed to happen, like messing around with other people's wives, like caring for people who are from other places, like loving the alien and welcoming the disenfranchised. And when those things don't happen, the covenant cracks and shakes. From David in the kingdom, Solomon became even more corrupt. And some of you remember in the progression of this kingdom time, Solomon had, I think it was 900 concubines and 300 wives. And some say, well, the reason Solomon failed so miserably was he was just tired. The kingdom didn't work. It collapsed. But the covenant survived. The people of God, some still remember, just a tiny remnant, were hanging on, understanding the power and the possibility and the purpose that God had for the people. As the progression happened, another disaster befalls the people, this time from an outside power, the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar, known as the Babylonian Empire. This little remnant of Judah is overwhelmed, and the Babylonians destroy the temple. For many, there was no longer the presence of Yahweh. It was complete disaster from both a physical standpoint, a societal experience, and a spiritual reality. It was a theological emergency. Where was God? The temple was destroyed. And in this time, there is still a surviving remnant. For Jeremiah emerges out of the ashes of this horror. And from the disaster, Jeremiah begins to be inspired to say, it's no longer about the temple. It's not even about the city of Jerusalem. Now the covenant becomes inscribed on our hearts. Now it becomes a personal thing where we who still remain committed to God's ways and the purposes that are outlined for us, we have to hang together and allow our hearts to be changed. Simultaneously with Jeremiah was Isaiah, who in the midst of this disaster, this exile, the destruction of the temple, the loss of social standing, this whole band of refugees now in a foreign place who don't speak the language are beginning to recognize it may be that God is not just our God, that God is not just about us. It may be in this foreign land with a different language and a different perspective, it may be that God is the God of all people. It may be in the midst of this disaster, it may be in this theological emergency, suddenly a whole new realm of understanding is opening to us, where we realize in the midst of our pain that it's not just us. It's a bigger picture. And what Isaiah then begins to use is a language that Paul adapts in the New Testament. It is time for us to see ourselves as a light unto the nations. All God's people, everywhere. It's not just here. It's not just me, but us with a capital U, much broader than we possibly imagine. It begins with Jeremiah and Isaiah and this opening up of the vision, but it continues to grow and progress. So from Noah and the bow and Abraham and the blessing, Moses and the mountain, David and the kingdom, Jeremiah and the heart, Moses to this newest covenant in the midst of disaster, Jesus and the cross. It was supposed to be the end. It was a movement of rabble-rousers and people kind of on the edge of society following Jesus. It made the religious establishment exceedingly uncomfortable. It troubled people who wanted stuff to just sort of stay the same, and for those who were in power, to stay in power. But the problem with Jesus was he kept saying things and telling stories that helped people see a bigger picture and made a lot of people uncomfortable. But with Jeremiah and Isaiah and recasting the original blessing of Abraham, this idea of blessing all the families of the earth began to be lived out, incarnated in Jesus. But the cross was supposed to be the end. It was a horrible state-sponsored vision and version of terrorism. It was a public execution that was to send a message to everybody: if you follow in this way, you will die like this. Painful, long-lasting, public, and you will die. And not only that, but your bones will be scattered by wild animals, and your family cannot bury you. In other words, your name will be erased from history. And the cross, through the horrible execution of crucifixion, was supposed to be the end. This is where the new covenant emerges. Out of disaster. Out of a theological emergency where once again the people of God are saying, what do we do now? Where is God in this horror? But the Bible tells us that after 3 days, something amazing happened. And this group of followers, who really, frankly, were just not that smart, began to suddenly have a new sense of vision and purpose and energy. And they began to understand the words that Jesus had shared with them in the Passover meal we know today as the Last Supper. And they began to realize resurrection is real among us. We began to realize that the bread held far more significance than we ever imagined. We began to find out that the wine was representative of something more than we ever dreamed. That resurrection was real then in Jesus. Resurrection is real now in our own storms and difficulties of life. Those times when we feel like, I just can't do this anymore. I am done with this. Where is God in this? And in the disaster emerges Jesus holding up the cup of the new covenant and saying, remember me. In those times when you need to be fortified, when you need to have the extra strength necessary to carry on in the difficulty, in the sadness, in the disaster, this is your meal to share. Here and worldwide, together, being fortified against the difficulties of life and for the goodness and beauty so that we can still be a blessing to all the families of the earth. And when that rocking ship of Zion is tossed and turned by the storms of life, the band continues to play, and we might just be able to dance. Thanks be to God.